On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's been the kind of week to make people hot under the collar. Senator Chuck Schumer accused Alberto Gonzalez of lying.
The attorney general took an oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Instead, he tells the half-truth, the partial truth, and everything but the truth.
Lieutenant General Ray Odierno said militant networks in Iraq are getting weapons and training from Iran.
One of the reasons why I think we're sitting down with the Iranian government, as we did yesterday, is trying to solve some of these problems, that in fact these weapons are coming across, and in fact, we believe some training is also going on inside of Iran.
And the Dow took a plunge.
Wall Street suffered one of its worst losses of the year in Thursday's trading. The Dow Industrials plummeted more than 311 points.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. We've got a great panel with us today. With me in studio is David Gergen, advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's now director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and editor-at-large for U.S. News and World Report. David, great to have you here.
Thanks.
Also with us from Washington is Ruth Marcus. She is an editorial writer and columnist for The Washington Post. Ruth, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. Nice to have you, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Ruth, and David.
David, I'll start with you. The top story this week from your perspective.
Sure. Well, increasingly, I think we ought to measure the weeks by whether the United States is making any serious progress toward solving its bigger problems. And this was another week when we had encountered frustration and, I think, basic gridlock in the system, underscored by the Gonzalez case. I mean, here's an attorney general who has been the proverbial man falling off a cliff, who's caught a branch on the way down, has been holding on for dear life. And each week we think he's going to fall. He doesn't. But the war with the Congress, the gathering opposition to him, I think is gradually sawing that branch off. He's going to fall. But I must say, from a point of view of governance, this is an attorney general who has been engulfed in problems now for some time. There is no trust in him in the Congress. The president is tenaciously hanging on to him, but I can't understand why. You know, to some degree, the president has a choice. Either he can keep Gonzalez or he can govern, but he can't do both.
Ruth, some senators are hinting they want to go after Gonzalez for perjury. Will that gain traction?
I don't think that it's going to gain a lot of headlines. I don't think it's going to end up in a prosecution. But to pick up on what David was saying, Alberto Gonzalez has been defying the laws of political gravity for some time now. I think David and I talked about it the last time we were on this program, and he's clinging onto this branch, but there's only really one person who's got the saw in his hand, and that's the president, and he doesn't seem to be particularly inclined to use it, and the attorney general didn't seem particularly perturbed about the pummeling that he was getting at the Judiciary Committee last week.
Well, let's listen to some of that during the hearing. Before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Attorney General Gonzalez testified that there was no disagreement about the domestic spying program, and he's questioned here by Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold.
The disagreement that occurred and the reason for the visit to the hospital center was about other intelligence activities. It was not about the terrorist surveillance program that the president announced to the American people. Now, I would like the opportunity.
Attorney General, do you expect us to believe that?
The senators also criticized Gonzalez for making false statements in the past. In this next clip, he's trying to defend himself while being questioned by New York Senator Chuck Schumer.
I clarified my statement 2 days later with the reporter.
What did you say to the reporter?
I did not speak directly to the reporter.
Oh, wait a second. You did not. Okay. What did your spokesperson say to the reporter?
I don't know, but I was told the spokesperson to go back and clarify my statement.
David Gergen, President Bush is known for his fierce loyalty. Is this fight really worth it for him?
I don't think so. There's a fear inside the White House that if he were to go, the confirmation process for his replacement would be terribly messy. I'd love to hear from Ruth on this because she's right there. But, you know, we've gone through this before after Don Rumsfeld left the Pentagon and Bob Gates got confirmed with relative ease. And I think there's a sense in Washington now that, people are pleased that there's a new defense secretary there and there's more trust in the Pentagon, and I think they've got better bridges to Democrats in terms of building some sort of a Iraq policy that could conceivably could be bipartisan. That's what Bob Gates had been working toward in part. So here I would think that the president will be well served by having someone, an attorney general, who can work through these problems. There are two sets of issues surrounding the attorney general, two messes really. One is over the firings of the U.S. attorneys. The other is over this electronic surveillance program and whether he has lied to the Congress about it. And his testimony now that he's given earlier this week about what happened in the electronic surveillance program has been flatly contradicted by at least three other members, key members of the administration itself, as well as by one senator, Jay Rockefeller, who was there in the meeting. So you've got a situation here now where there's a very serious question of whether he's lied to Congress. I mean, that is I don't remember a situation in which we've had someone who is an attorney general testify and his own testimony be undercut by statements of people who work for the same president.
Ruth Marcus, can you remember such a time?
Well, I've covered a lot of attorneys general who have been in some hot water with Congress or elsewhere, and this is pretty much as good or bad as it gets. But a couple points about what David is saying. I think that the Gates analogy is very interesting, and I think one of the wrinkles that is different here than was with the replacement of Rumsfeld is that while lawmakers are certainly as anxious for the attorney general to go as they were for Don Rumsfeld to go, one of the concerns that the White House has that it didn't necessarily have when it was replacing Rumsfeld is the leverage that this would give lawmakers to try to get some of the documents and testimony that they've been trying to pry with not very much success out of the administration. And if you remember, the Gates replacement came during the very short, very fleeting honeymoon that occurred in the aftermath of the 2006 election when everybody was still trying to either pretend or make themselves believe that they were going to get along and it was going to be a new era of bipartisan cooperation and civility. And I think this week has demonstrated that era is long over.
Jack Beatty, would the president be well served to cut Gonzalez free?
He would indeed. But, you know, haunting all of this is what was the nature of the program that Ashcroft and Comey objected to and made, you know, that famous meeting where Gonzalez went to Ashcroft's bedside and said, you know, you've got to sign these documents, and they wouldn't do it. And then the Justice Department forced a stop to that program. We still don't know what that program X was. They don't want that to come out. And I think somehow this whole, quote, loyalty to Gonzalez is about keeping that out of the public eye. But I think the best comment on this week was delivered by John Stewart, who said, Alberto Gonzalez is saying basically there are problems of which he cannot speak, for which he is responsible, yet not to blame, and that he is the only one who can clean up a mess he can neither confirm nor deny.
Well, let's move on a little bit. What about the House vote in committee to endorse the criminal prosecution against former White House counsel Harriet Myers and Bush aide Josh Bolten? Are we in for another showdown on this one, David Gergen?
I'm not so sure. In this instance, this other mess, I believe, and I've been surprised, frankly, that Fred Fielding, as the new counsel, general counsel, who has got a long record that is well respected in Washington of figuring out ways to work well with the Congress from the White House over these kind of contentious questions of executive privilege. He's worked this out in the past. The big surprise is that this White House, with Fred as general counsel, has not. I have to believe that he's been overruled in what he would normally attempt to do. And and it's led to this what appears to be a showdown. I have to tell you that from a legal standpoint, The White House has a much, much better argument on this about executive privilege. Normally, though, what presidents do is they assert executive privilege. They don't go to court over it. They assert executive privilege, and they waive it in a particular case. And this, in this instance, it would, I think, would be reasonably easy to work out an agreement whereby Harriet Myers and Josh Bolten could testify under oath, which the White House objects to. And they could compromise on that and still do it in private, in effect, away from cameras. And the Congress could get the kind of answers it's looking for. I don't think this is a hard problem to solve if you've got the will and the records too. They'd have to have some passing of records.
Here's White House spokesman Tony Snow about the contempt charges against Josh Bolten and Harriet Myers, calling them ridiculous.
In our view, this is pathetic. There is an attempt to do something that's never been done in American history, which is to assail the concept of executive privilege, which hails back to the administration of George Washington. And in particular, to use criminal contempt charges against the White House Chief of Staff and the White House Legal Counsel.
What do you think, Ruth Marcus? Can Democrats prevail with contempt charges?
Well, I don't think that Tony Snow is right when he says it's never been done in American history. The Republican Congress actually was on the verge of voting contempt charges against President Clinton's White House counsel, Jack Quinn. And I didn't hear that kind of complaining.
We're talking about the week in the news. My guests this hour are Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post, David Gergen of U.S. News and World Report, and the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and our own Jack Beatty. The House approved contempt citations against two Bush administration officials, Harriet Myers and Josh Bolten. Here's Wisconsin Republican James Sensenbrenner. This is what he said if the president is challenged in court. Sensenbrenner says he'll probably win.
And that is going to be viewed as a blank check by the present president and the future president to do whatever they want to effectively stiff the Congress in discharging their oversight responsibilities.
California Democrat Adam Schiff says the refusal by former White House counsel Harriet Myers to even show up warrants a contempt citation.
The audacity of that takes your breath away. On the question of whether an administration or foreign administration official can simply blow off a subpoena and not show up, there is no legal support for that whatsoever. That is beyond the pale.
Jack Beatty, you wanted to jump in before the break. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that you see now another model mentioned. It's mentioned in Ruth's paper this morning of inherent contempt. This is a process whereby the Congress, the sergeant of arms, in the Congress goes and arrests the person who's under contempt citation, brings them to the House or the whatever the forum might be, and effectively there's a kind of trial of this person on the issues raised. And this has been done rarely. It was almost done in the 80s with Ann Gorsuch of the Environmental Protection Agency. Congress was ready to do it. And I don't know whether it'll come to it again, but that's a possibility where this whole issue of, well, who'll serve the writ is bypassed, and Congress, through this inherent contempt power, acts as its own judge and jury.
I think Congress would be a little reluctant to do that, but I think there is a third way, which is Congress can go to court and seek to enforce its subpoena. It doesn't have the weight and sort of scariness and possibly political attractiveness of having somebody held in contempt of court and jailed, but it does provide a mechanism to get the courts, which really, the two other branches ought to be able to sort this out. But if the courts need to umpire this, that might be a mechanism to do it that would be a little less traumatic than Congress opening up whatever jail it has.
Agree, David Gergen?
I think Ruth is right. It does seem to me that it's not appropriate here to go wandering off into new legal thickets and get lost in there with various kinds of procedures here. What we have is a Congress that has voted, a House that's voted contempt citations, but we have an administration that's been holding the Congress in contempt on this issue now for some time. It strikes me that we've got much larger problems to solve in this country, and we need to get on with it. What ought to happen here is the president ought to find a new attorney general, and in the process of getting that person confirmed, work this out so that you clear the air on a couple of these areas, and let's get on with the bigger problems. We're getting wrapped around the axle here on things that are sort of they're important, but they're not central. And we've got much bigger problems to solve. You can't, in this environment, it is very hard for the president to work out any kind of sort of agreement on where we're going from here in Iraq and what we're going to be doing in the Middle East. And when the Congress is roiled up like this, and people like Arlen Specter, a Republican, and other Republicans are just extremely frustrated with this White House, it's time to sort of for the White House to sort of think this thing through and say, isn't there a better way we can govern?
You know, under this heading, David, of getting on with the real business of the country, I think we need to give a bow to Condoleezza Rice. What's been happening in recent months is remarkable. She has cleared a space for the professional diplomats, Chris Hill in Korea, Ryan Crocker in Iraq, to talk to the enemy, to actually begin the process of my gosh, and the labor in Korea is incredible, up and down. But now in Iraq, Crocker has met with the Iranian foreign minister, and they have come up with they're going to form a committee, the United States and Iran, dealing with trying to rein in the militias, fight al-Qaeda, and address issues of border security. And, you know, this wouldn't have happened. Cheney wouldn't have let this happen earlier in the administration, but Rice has won a space for these people to do what we want them to do. And I although, you know, my enthusiasm for her has always been under control, I think that now, I mean, she really has is performing a service in terms of getting on with the real problems of the country.
I think that's absolutely right, Jack. I'm less impressed by the progress with Iran than you are, but I think that the point you're making about talks is absolutely right, and she does deserve a lot of credit for it.
Ruth Marcus, a new diplomacy.
Well, I'm glad that Jack has his irrational exuberance under control, but I'd point out that this sort of new realism that I think we see in the conduct of foreign policy, it's not translating into the administration's dealings with the Hill. It was remarkable this week. We had Arlen Specter on Air Force One still dissing the Attorney General, who he had just been brutal about, and I think actually warrantedly so, on the president's own plane. You have the president taking on two other powerful Republican senators, Chuck Grassley of Iowa, Orrin Hatch of Utah, on a program that ought to be the kind of thing an administration in trouble would sort of wrap itself around, which is health care for poor children. And instead, the administration is kind of going to war against and threatening to veto a bipartisan plan on health care. So whatever kind of good things seem to be going on, and, you know, good is a relative term, on the foreign policy front, there's some, I think, actually kind of weird stuff going on back here in Washington.
Let's move on for a moment to another big story this week on Wall Street. The Dow lost more than 300 points on Thursday. Similar drops followed in Europe. This morning in Tokyo, the Nikkei dropped 2.5%. Trouble starting in one of the shakiest sectors of finance, the home mortgages sector for people with bad credit. That's spreading now. The question is, David Gergen, how far and how fast will it go?
I don't think anybody knows, and there's a lot of nervousness now. I don't pretend to be an expert on finance, but what is obvious is that at the same time we've got the subprime housing market problem is spreading. So it's not just the high credit risks are unable to pay their mortgages, but indeed a lot of middle class Americans are now find themselves caught and they're defaulting, and that's what so it's rippling out, it's spreading out, and that's caused enormous anxiety within the credit markets, and what you're seeing is a drying up of credit. And this economy has, to a significant degree, depended upon the availability of easy credit for all sorts of deals that have been going forward, and especially in the private equity companies, that when they go out and buy a company and take it private, they do that by doing a lot of borrowing. That's the leverage they get in order to do the deal. Now, when the credit dries up, it makes it a lot harder to get that kind of borrowing done. In other words, and the stock market has had a lot of increase because of that. So we've got our problems here at home. I don't think we're right on the verge of recession or anything like that. We've got our problems at home. We have to contrast that with what's going on in the world at large. The International Monetary Fund came out this week and just upped its growth estimates for the world as a whole to a growth rate in this coming year of 5%. That's extraordinarily high. The world economy is doing very well, and so we're in a little shakier place than we were, but we have to see it within a broader context that a lot of good things are going on in the international economy.
Before we bring callers into the conversation, and they're lining up here this week, we saw the first presidential debate, courtesy of YouTube and CNN. I want to play part of that YouTube debate. Monday night, Senator Barack Obama was asked if he would engage with countries like Iran and Cuba.
I would. And the reason is this, that the notion that somehow not talking to countries is punishment to them, which has been the guiding diplomatic principle of this administration, is ridiculous.
Hillary Clinton followed Barack Obama's reply with an attack and a response her campaign is touting as being more nuanced.
I think it is not that you promise a meeting at that high a level before you know what the intentions are. I don't want to be used for propaganda purposes. I don't want to make a situation even worse.
Is this a preview, Ruth Marcus, of the themes we're going to be hearing in the months to come here?
Oh, sure. And the Democratic race got a lot more interesting with that exchange and with the follow-up that happened afterwards. First, Senator Clinton came out saying that Senator Obama's remarks had been frankly naive. Then Senator Obama yesterday, and I think this was somewhat of making some lemonade out of some debate lemons on his part, said that Senator Clinton's view was Bush-Cheney light and whoopee, fun for us in the dog days of summer. I have to say, I think that Senator Clinton has the better of this argument, both substantively and politically, because the entire question to Senator Obama and the others was without preconditions. And he sort of leapt on that and said yes. And I think Senator Clinton showed her experience, honestly, in the answer of no, yes, I want to engage more than the Bush administration has. But no, we're not going to just, as Senator Obama said, have him over for a cup of coffee instantly. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't endorsing that either.
I want to welcome one of our callers to join our conversation. Jack from Davenport, Iowa, has a thought about this particular subject. Jack, go ahead.
Yes. Hello, Jane.
Hello.
I'd like to address the issue about what you're just talking about now about the YouTube debate. Those comments were made on the debate and the day after. And let me say once again, those comments were really hypothetical, because we are imagining situations that are happening in our minds and without addressing real issues. Because after all, Bill Clinton met with people, Nixon met with Khrushchev. All down history, we have, these meetings. The day after, Hillary Clinton first attacked Barack Obama. When Barack Obama defended himself, we see Hillary Clinton go into almost a swift boat attack at his strongest strength. Where is the politics of hope, she said. And then later in the day, she said it was silly. So let's get a substantial debate.
Jack, thank you for your call. Martin is calling now from Boston, Massachusetts. Martin, hello to you.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really think that Barack Obama was right on key. Abba even once said that you negotiate peace with your enemies, not with your friends. And to somehow close out the option of going directly to the people who are most have most need to be talking to seems foolish. The thing that worries me about Hillary Clinton is that the Clintons have shown that they will do whatever they need to do to get elected and stay in the White House, and that'll include negotiations. It's nice to have somebody who really stands on principle and is willing to do what needs to be done.
Martin, thank you for your call. Lots of movement among the Democrats this week. David Gergen, what about the Republican field? What's your take?
Well, up until now, it's been the Democratic field. It's been rather static. I mean, the race has been static. If anything, Mrs. Clinton has seems to have solidified her lead. Just to finish that up, I happen to believe that Ruth Marcus is right in her analysis. I did think Mrs. Clinton, having won the substance of the debate, made a political mistake by going after Barack Obama the next day and calling him irresponsible and frankly naive. I just thought it reminded us once again that she does have a sharp tongue, and I thought one of the things that was working for her was that she seemed to be more gracious and warmer in these debates. I thought that was helping her. So any event, leaving that aside, on the Republican side, there's been much more volatility among the Republican candidates, you know, especially with the downfall of the John McCain campaign. He's not out of it, but he's almost out of money, which is a real problem for him. But what's striking is that if you look at the Republican side, Rudy Giuliani, when he declared back in February, was at about a 40%. About 40% of Republican identified voters said they would like to vote for him in the primaries, and Fred Thompson was at about 10. Giuliani had about a 30-point lead. That lead is now over. Thompson has now shrunk to 6-8%. And here, Fred Thompson hasn't even gotten into the race. I mean, somebody told me the other day that Fred Thompson is not going to run this race from a rocking chair. He's going to run it from a lounge chair.
Hey, Jack Beatty, I want to turn to you for a moment because I'd like you to jump in about an event this week, a lonely crusade on the floor of the House of Representatives. Tell us about it.
Yes. On Tuesday afternoon, Representative Jeff Flake of Arizona, a Republican, often called a conservative, and is a conservative, stood up and in case after case introduced amendments that would strike earmarks from an appropriation bill. And he would make his case, and then the representative whose district the earmark was in would come to the floor with great indignation and say that, you know, projects like the, $750,000 for the Alliance for Nano Health in Houston, Texas, were vital to national security. And Flake would say, I submit the amendment. And then we will call for the yeas and nays, and you'd hear, no, no, and Flake's lone voice, yes, the nays have it. The gentleman's amendment is refused. For what purposes does the gentleman rise? And then Flake would try it again. And, this business of earmarking and the way the parties on both sides joined immediately defending this turf, it showed us really we have in some respects a party of incumbency in Washington. and a guy like Flake who's saying, wait a minute, this is $60 billion in earmarks we're talking about, and who's trying to, you know, do the work for the taxpayer, no, 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 and no again to what he wanted.
Ruth Marcus, on an unrelated note, but still very important topic, the latest report on the health and medical treatment of veterans released this week shows how far-reaching the mental and physical scars will last. Remind us of that.
Well, a report came out this week from a commission that was appointed by the president, and it found that the costs in money and the costs in physical health for caring for the veterans that are coming home from Iraq, both with enormous physical injuries. The death rate in Iraq is significantly down from what it was in the war in Vietnam, but people are surviving with injuries that would have once been fatal and that are going to have long-lasting pain. There is also an enormous amount of mental health consequences for many of the folks coming back, and I think it just underscores the cost that this war, literal and metaphysical, have inflicted on this country, and that we're going to be paying those costs long after the last soldiers are gone.
We're talking about the week in the news. My guests this hour are Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post, David Gergen of U.S. News and World Report, and the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and our own Jack Beatty. Atlanta Falcons quarterback Michael Vick this week strode into court and pleaded not guilty to charges that he engaged in a dogfight operation. Animal rights activists lined the sidewalks.
If you look at these poor dogs, you know, they were never given a chance. They were bred, trained, drugged, and then put in a pit to tear each other to shreds.
Comedian Drew Carey this week told David Letterman that he just learned he'll be the next game show host calling contestants to come on down.
15 minutes ago, they called me. It's a done deal. I'm the new host of The Price is Right.
Oh, my God.
And study results published in yesterday's New England Journal of Medicine found that the cause of obesity often lies in a person's social network.
What we found is that the strongest effects were seen between friends. So a friend gaining weight had a very big effect on an individual gaining weight.
Some of the stories in the news this week. Back to Iraq for a moment. In a speech this week, President Bush said that al-Qaeda in Iraq was essentially the same organization that attacked the United States on September 11th, and that it is by far the biggest threat facing Iraqis and U.S.-led coalition troops there. David Gergen, Bush's comments were met with skepticism by some terrorism experts and former U.S. intelligence officials, saying presidents exaggerated or even misrepresented these facts. How does it shake out with you?
Well, the president's got a point about al-Qaeda and Iraq being increasingly allied with al-Qaeda internationally, and that it is dangerous. But there is, I believe, a well-founded view that this is that he's obfuscating the larger picture, and that this is intentionally trying to seize on one element of what's going on in Iraq and trying to make it the only element. You know, Colin Powell, his own Secretary of State, is now saying, you know, al-Qaeda in Iraq is only about 10% of the problem in Iraq, the military problem. Sectarian violence is a much, much bigger problem. So I understand rhetorically why the president's trying to go here in order to make one last sort of ditch argument. But again, it does seem to me that it's at a time when this administration should be trying to figure out where are we going from here? How do we build a coalition politically at home that can sustain our position over time? When he should be sitting down with veterans like Dick Lugar and his own party and John Warner and figuring this out, and then with leading Democrats to figure out where we're going to go, our problem is going to be, frankly, that what we're facing is a possibility that this administration will work out a policy and will limp along here for a while. It's going to be extremely controversial. We'll have a national election. The Democrats may well win the White House, and then we had a U-turn in policy. That is a terrible way to conduct foreign policy. What they ought to be trying to figure out is what is a sustainable American policy that can be sustained whoever wins the next election for the long haul. What's the strategy we have in this part of the world? There is no sense of strategy. We're all into tactics now. This question, you know, a lot of these issues are tactical. They're not strategic.
As it relates to Iraq, during a press conference, David, yesterday in Baghdad, Army Lieutenant General Ray Odierno said there's a reason that militants who have been firing into Baghdad are getting better.
We have seen in the last 3 months a significant improvement in the capability of mortarmen and rocketeers to provide accurate fires into the Green Zone and other places. We think this is directly related to training that was conducted in Iran.
Ruth Marcus, rare talks between the U.S. and Iran this week. Where do you think those talks are headed?
Well, they didn't seem to be particularly warm and fuzzy. There was a little bit of lecturing, and probably deservedly so, by the U.S. to Iran, saying, hey, cut it out. You guys are making this problem worse, and you need to start trying to make it better. I think more broadly, David's exactly right, and I'm sorry to be in such a sort of kumbaya moment with them. We need to find something to disagree on, and I bet we can. But Republicans and Democrats, the whole country needs to start to have a very serious conversation about what we are going to do going forward. If al-Qaeda in Iraq disappeared tomorrow, we would still have an enormous problem in Iraq with sectarian violence, and it's not going to disappear tomorrow. And so we need to have a conversation about how we are going to wind this down in a way that is most protective of U.S. interests. You hear some of the Democratic candidates on the campaign trail and some of the Democrats in Congress saying, what we need to do is just get out of Iraq. Well, that's nice. Everybody would like to do that. But we need to have a serious conversation about, are we going to stand by and allow genocide to go on, the kind of genocide that we're decrying in Darfur? Are we going to, whatever the role of al-Qaeda in Iraq is now, are we going to stand by and let terrorist groups operate in Iraq as a safe haven? How are we going to protect our continuing interests in the region? That's the conversation that folks like Senator Lugar want to have, and that we haven't really managed to engage with all this screaming and yelling.
David?
Before Jack jumps in, just brief coda to that, which I agree with. The longer this goes on without a real consensus, the more the Democratic candidates are veering off to the left, as Ruth says, and they're getting more and more into the posture of just pull all the troops out. We're not going to leave anybody in there. And that happens to be I just happen to disagree with that position. I think it's not in our national interest. But the president's going to lose control of this debate, and you're going to have chaos in our policy. And that was what Senator Lugar was warning us against and warning the White House against a few weeks ago. Don't wait. Try to build a consensus now about the long-term strategy while you still can sit down with people in a reasonable way.
Yeah, but I think politics drives this, David, and I think it's the politics of the future. They're going to keep this disaster going till January 2009, the Democrats will be the party that, quote, lost Iraq. Yeah. I mean, you just see Karl Rove building that, I'm afraid, you know, to say, oh, no, they wouldn't do that. Well, you know, we know that politics drives policy and that Rove drives politics in this administration. And I'm afraid that's the scenario shaping up. They don't want a consensus. They want an issue for the future.
David?
Jack, unfortunately, may be absolutely right.
Jack, let's stick with you for a moment to another issue I know that you thought was important this week, a new report within the business community about globalization. What was it?
Well, this is the invaluable David Wessel in yesterday's Wall Street Journal outlined this, and this is a report from 20 chief executives of 20 huge financial companies on globalization, and they say it's good for the U.S., the gains aren't being shared, and to avoid a big backlash about it, something's got to be done. What? Well, among other things, they say raise taxes on the winners of globalization to share benefits with those who aren't doing so well. Two, have something like wage insurance. My gosh, this used to be a left-wing idea. So that to cushion the pain of people losing jobs. And three, to even find out a way to help communities deal with the closing of factories and that sort of thing. And these people say unless steps like that are taken, eventually, and maybe eventually it'll be sooner rather than later, there is going to be a backlash against globalization that could result in protectionism.
Jack, thank you.
I think
Ruth, go ahead.
I think we're already seeing that backlash, and I think just listen to Democrats on the campaign trail and look at their stances on trade agreements, and I think the conversation needs to center around not opposing globalization or lamenting its effects or promoting globalization, but figuring out a way to have globalization that takes into account its terrible consequences for individuals, and I think this is a very welcome report.
I agree with that, and it is distressing to see Mrs. Clinton in particular abandoning the free trade policies of her husband, who I think was really trying to help the Democratic Party move into a more reasonable position. But on this report, what's really striking, I think Jack is right about this, is a really interesting report, is how many instances we're now seeing in which CEOs who've been so berated for their sort of resistance to change are the ones actually stepping out front. CEOs are really taking the lead now on climate change. Jeff Immelt, Duke Power, and other people like that. They're pushing now for education. Eli Broad and Bill Gates Jr. pushing on education reform. We've got a whole group of CEOs who are now trying to push for reforming the healthcare system, and some are coming out, in fact, for single-payer type systems. And now you've got these CEOs saying you've got to really worry about globalization and its impact, and maybe we have to raise taxes on some of the winners. It's a really interesting set of trends that we're seeing among some of the CEOs.
Now enlightened self-interest, Tocqueville would call it.
Now to the phones. Diana calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Diana, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Go ahead. Hi.
I'm calling because something is happening that's really concerning me with the media. I still blame the media, both the conservative and the liberal media, for whipping the American people into a frenzy about going into the war in Iraq. They didn't point out the inconsistencies and the obvious errors. And now what worries me is that they're continuing to tell us what to think. An example is Barack and Hillary. Many American people liked what Barack Obama said about talking to people. And I personally like Hillary and Barack both. But it disturbs me to hear the media within 10 minutes after the debate immediately saying that Hillary is right and Barack is wrong. So that's the point I want to make. I would really love it if the media could be more open and not try to tell Americans what to think.
All right, Diana, thank you. Any of our panelists want to tackle that caller's concern?
Well, I think it's a little bit hard to talk about the media as if it's one monolithic entity and that we manage to have, because we're so organized, some kind of instant group conference call to figure out what to say. I mean, I think that reporters listening to the debate thought this could be a misstep on Obama's part, and they appropriately wrote about it in that sense. Opinion folks such as myself are entitled to make judgments, and that's what we get paid for, about who has the better of that argument. So I understand the caller's concern and her frustration with the reporting on the run-up to the war, but anybody who wanted to listen to that debate and make their own judgment was perfectly entitled to listen to it.
Ruth Marcus, let me stick with you for a moment and ask you about the children's health care bill now before Congress. You see a real fight brewing over this important legislation.
It's going to be a huge fight, and it's going to be a very interesting one. The president, essentially, before even the first bipartisan Senate measure, which I mentioned earlier, before the ink was dry on that, in fact, before it was released, started suggesting that he was going to veto it. And the White House is trying to argue that the problem with this program is that it's going to bring in a government takeover of health care, and we hear a lot of dark mutterings about Hillary care, and that it's going to drive a lot of people off of private insurance into public insurance. And the White House has actually a very interesting proposal to try to help people buy private insurance. But the fact of the matter is that we have 9 million children in this country who are without health insurance. Of those, 6 million are already eligible but not enrolled in programs. We ought to be in programs for low-income coverage like Medicaid and SCHIP. If there's one thing that people ought to be able to agree on in a bipartisan way, it ought to be getting as many of those 6 million children enrolled as we possibly can. And that just doesn't seem to be happening.
So, David, what's the concern about this bill, would you say, at the White House and among Republican leaders in both houses?
The costs. And let me just say, for starters, I agree with Ruth about her.
David.
What's that? I know. Let me figure out something I can disagree with you. But the on the point of view, people in the news media business who are in the opinion side, not the news side, do need to be able to offer judgments as to which side is right or wrong on the merits, and let people make up their – American people can then go on and they can hear a lot of commentators on both sides. On this SCHIP question, here's what basically has happened. We had a long, long fight in this country to make sure that the elderly were protected in terms of health, and we got Medicare. It took a long, long time to get there, but most Americans would now agree that's a good idea. When the Clinton health care plan failed in terms of trying to provide universal access and do something about costs, over time since then, there has been an effort by both parties to say, okay, we've got the elderly covered through Medicare. Let's now try to cover low-income children who are also vulnerable in a Medicare-type way, and that's what was called this Children's Health Insurance Program, or State Health Children's Health, it's SCHIP or CHIP. But as Ruth points out, we've only covered a portion of the children. We're spending $25 billion a year. And the White House comes along in its new budget and says, by the way, we'll spend over the next 5 years $1 billion a year extra. And that turns out to actually let more children go off, because you're actually decreasing the amount of money you're spending and you have more children who are uninsured. And so the Democrats, along with Republicans, are coming back and saying, wait a minute, this is a good idea to make sure children are covered. So we need to increase the size of it. I cannot understand why the White House, which is, you know, can spend money with abandon in Iraq and has been, was willing to go with prescription drugs, is not willing to go with what is a program that's now supported by both sides. We are going to have much, much bigger arguments about what do we do about adults who are working, who are in low-income places, who don't have health insurance. And should we use the private sector or use the public sector or some mix? That's a big, big argument to come. But this, for children who are poor and who are vulnerable and who don't have an equal shot in life, because they don't, in part because they don't have health care insurance, it seems to me is one on which most people have agreed.
Yeah, I think the tobacco lobby is involved in this too, because the bill would be paid for in large part, as I understand it, by a substantial increase in tobacco taxes, which strikes me as eminently, you know, a win-win, discouraging smoking and taking care of kids. But the tobacco lobby is very important in the Republican Party.
With 2 minutes left, less than 2 minutes, let me shift gears very briefly here and talk about the latest presidential poll numbers out this week. Washington Post, ABC News poll showing George W. Bush is the most unpopular president in the history of modern polling. 65% of Americans disapprove of his presidency. So the question, with 18 months left, with the immigration bill dead, what are his legislative hopes now in the remainder of this presidency? Quickly, David Gergen.
Well, he's gone from the president who had one of the highest popularity ratings in history to the president who's got one of the lowest popularity ratings, one of the highest disapproval ratings in history. So it's absolutely remarkable. I think as long as the Gonzales fight goes on and we have continuing tensions and disagreements and contempt on both sides on Iraq, it's going to be very hard to get anything else done legislatively.
20 seconds, Ruth.
I don't think he has legislative hopes. I think at this point he has political hopes, which are to demonize and label Democrats as big tax and spenders, veto appropriations bills, and hope that that resonates with voters.
Jack, you have the last word in 20 seconds.
Yes, I misspoke. I said that all the amendments striking earmarks were struck down. No, majority voted against the perfect Christmas tree project. Courage.
All right, let that be the last word. David, David Gergen and Ruth Marcus and Jack Beatty. Thanks so much, all of you, for your time and your insights today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.